Welcome to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Steve Sandy, founder of Apple World Today. Steve, good afternoon. Thank you for being with me on the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, John. It's been a while since we've had a chat, so this should be fun.
Yeah, I think so. We've known each other for quite a while, just haven't managed to get together. We live fairly close to each other in the Denver area, and that's kind of cool. And we have had lunch many times, and I'm really happy to have you on the show because you are one of the most interesting and informed and personable people I know in the Apple community.
Oh, thank you. Man, that's the nicest thing anybody said to me in years. Well, it's not that sad, but I do appreciate that. Thanks, John. And, you know, of course, I feel the same way about you, which is why we get along so well.
Yes, and I want to talk about that in a few minutes. Listeners, we got to know each other when I was wanting to learn how to use iWeb years ago, and I was looking around on the internet, and I found this wonderful take control book called, what was it called? iWeb.
Oh, yeah, Take Control of iWeb.
iWeb, right. And I thought the book was so beautifully written and so clear, I thought, oh, I got to get to know who this guy is and make contact with him. And then I found out that you're not very far away from me. And then we met for lunch, and we discovered something interesting at lunch the first time. We're twins. We were separated at birth.
Except you got the hair on the top of your head, and I got it on my face.
So, yeah, what little I have left, right? So we started talking, and we discovered that all of a sudden, you know, like everything we talked about, it just synced. You know, Macintoshes and our interest in cars and
astronomy.
Astronomy and cats. So it was an amazing first visit. So I wanted to ask you, for starters, so since we're both sort of dyed-in-the-wool Apple guys, how did you get started in all this?
Well, I always tell people I actually had a life in computers before I ever set hands on an Apple device. And it actually goes back to, I think it was 1969. At that time, I was in junior high school and was, I'm trying to remember exactly what class it was in. But anyway, the school system, Aurora Public Schools, had a at that time, I think it was a Nova or one of the other mini computers that were out at that point that they were using for scheduling, and they're using it for accounting and all these other things. And some brilliant person in the school district realized that if they went out and bought up surplus teletypes that had little acoustic coupler modems hooked up to them, that the schools could each have their own computer. In other words, we could dial in, we could do, you know, I guess you could almost call it time sharing off of this Nova. So at that time, you know, we were just, you know, of course, a group of kids sitting around writing basic programs because that's all they would let us do. And that was kind of the start. And then when I got to college, University of Colorado, in 1975, a very good friend of mine who has since sadly passed away, he was an electrical engineering student. I was a civil engineering student. And one day, you know, because he knew that I was a nerd and I used to sit around and, you know, solder things together like synthesizer kits. And he says, hey,
oh, regular Steve Wozniak, were you?
No, not that good. But anyway, he says, hey, you want? I'm going to buy one of these MITS Altair kits.
Oh, yes.
You want to help me solder it together? And so, you know, he had the money. I didn't. He went ahead, bought the kit, and we sat around and got that thing all put together. And then you'd flip switches on it.
Is this the one where you had like 8 switches in the front or 16, and you would flip it on or off for the binary code and say enter?
Yep.
And that was the first line of machine code. And then you'd go to the next line and enter the next one.
Yes, it was.
That's how we entered code in the old days, listeners.
Yeah. So, well, you can tell, you know, at that time when we got this thing put together and he was showing me how you'd program it, I was going, this isn't that great, you know. So the next summer, I think it was, I believe it was 76, we actually went down to Albuquerque during the summer, and they were having a Mitz Alter kind of like world convention down there, because that's where Mitz was based. Actually, I knew them before they started making computers, because I was deeply, deeply into model rocketry, and they used to make telemetry transmitters and, you know, accelerometers, different things like that that you could put on model rockets. So that's where I got to know Mitz. And then all of a sudden, one day, I see they're making computers in Popular Electronics magazine, and I went, huh, interesting. Couldn't afford it, but fortunately, my friend Rick could. Anyway, the next summer, we went down there. By that point, we had found a used teletype, and we were actually using that to read in programs that people had on paper tape. I had a paper tape reader on it. And we would also, we figured out a way of doing copies.
Paper tape. Was the giant leap forward as opposed to setting switches on the front of the machine.
Hey, it was wonderful at that point. We actually also went ahead and at that point got it hooked up to a TV set so you could actually see output on the screen. So, and we,
What kind of program could one run in that mode? I mean, it was all text-based stuff, right? There was no graphics yet.
Well, at that point, it was pretty much all text, and so we were writing little programs like, they were pretty bad. We did one that was character-based tic-tac-toe. We had actually played with that back in junior high school together. So this was kind of one of our first programs that we put on there, and it would line by line draw out a tic-tac-toe, you know, board there, the nine squares, and then you would enter in, I think we had it set up A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, and you would, it would say, you know, it would put in an X, and then you would say, where would you want to put O, and you'd say, oh, put that in C, or, you know, put it in.
Now, this sounds primitive, but the joy of having a computer of your own and operating it and programming it and learning completely swamped the end result, which was oh so primitive.
Absolutely. And, well, the cool thing was, too, when we were down there at that Mitz Alter convention, I don't remember what the heck they called it, but like I said, 1976 during the summer, Rick ended up buying a copy of Microsoft Basic from, guess who?
Bill Gates.
Yeah, and I don't remember even seeing Bill Gates or Microsoft there. So either I was totally unimpressed or I know we did the night
before. Teenager with glasses. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we were all teenagers with glasses at that point. But it was funny because he, you know, Rick ended up buying a copy of that, and I remember we handed out a few copies to close friends in the Boulder area. So that was a lot of fun. But anyway, that was my first experience with computers.
I bet when the Apple II came out, then you went, uh-oh, Apple II, bingo, this is the machine, right?
No.
No?
Well, you're going to find this weird. I guess you could say, you know, first I was interested in making it through school. So I got my engineering degree, and then I started a job, and I got into an MBA program. And so I was really busy with a lot of things. And believe it or not, about the first time I finally saw a computer that I thought, you know, this looks like it could be fun, was a Commodore VIC-20. And I got this thing home, hooked it up to the TV, and immediately said, it doesn't have enough memory. So I brought it back to the store, and by the time I had brought it back to the store, they'd actually reduced the price on the Commodore 64 to the point that I not only got the Commodore 64 as an exchange, but I actually got money back. So I had that for about a year, just, you know, wrote a lot of little programs, did some sprite programming, wrote a couple little simple games. And then I got tired of that, and I went and I did not buy an Apple machine. Guess what I bought?
PET.
No, it was a PC clone. It was a it was a machine that was actually made by Sanyo, of all companies. It was called an MBC, which I think was Microsoft based computer or something like that, or machine business.
I never heard of that one.
But it was a Sanyo MBC 555. And I think it came with, I think I had actually 128K of RAM in it. It had two floppy drives and a really bad design because they tried to make it all chrome, you know, a very shiny looking machine. Mm-hmm. Of course, in our dry Colorado climate, anytime you got in near the darn thing and touched it, you would get a static shock and that would reset the computer. So that was a bit of a problem.
But the goal was to have your office desk look like the bridge of the Enterprise, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that was our goal. I mean, we had this thing, and it was a computer, and it had a display. And yeah, it was so exciting. You felt like you were just on the stepping stone of the future.
Well, then the Macintosh came out, and I fell in love. And it was December, just about this time in 1984, when the 512K was out. It wasn't even the 512K enhanced at that point.
The Fat Mac?
But it was the Fat Mac, and that was my first Macintosh, and I haven't looked back since.
Yep, same here, although I took a different path. I was in graduate school and up to my ears in computers and had been using mainframes with Fortran.
And oh, yeah.
So when the Apple II came out, I was at White Sands Missile Range. And so we had these beautiful big computers. And so when I had a chance to buy an Apple II and have one at home, I thought this was great. And then I started doing benchmarks. And I found out that our mainframe at White Sands was something on the order of 1,000 to 10,000 times faster than the Apple II. But still, the things you could do with it. And you could digest that 2K of ROM and pour through the Red Book, and you could learn everything there was to know about this computer,
yeah,
which was amazing. So flash forward to today, or maybe not. We didn't look back after we had the original Macintoshes, and we sort of flowed through the technical timeline.
Oh, yeah.
So how did you get into the writing business?
Well, strangely enough, I had always liked to write. And in fact, I can recall back in, man, that must have been like, well, it was about the time I got the Commodore 64. I realized that there were a lot of people who were questioning, how do I do this? How do I do that? And they needed something written very simply. They needed to have, you know, somebody really take them step by step through that. So I sat down, and at that time I didn't really understand the publishing business, but I wrote I think it was like half of a book on using the Commodore 64 and doing sprite programming for games. And I went ahead and sent it out. At that time, that's what you did. You took your copies of your manuscript and you put them in an envelope and you mailed them off to as many publishing companies as you could. And it got rejected by all of them. But anyway, I at least gave it a chance. Later on, you know, like I said, I've always liked writing. I think it was 2004, I decided to kind of put my hand into it again, and I wrote a book that was at the time called Beyond the Music, and it was talking about all these different things that you could do with the iPod. And of course, at that time, it was like the iPod Classic is, or, you know, the similar type hard drive setup. But I wrote this book, and I found all these wonderful things you could do, like even running, you know, a version of Linux on it, you know, all these different things. So I self-published. It did okay, but not great. And at that point, I you know, had been following Adam Engst's Tidbits site since before there were web browsers, you know, because I got his book and got onto the internet like so many of us did. But I realized that they were doing publishing. So I went ahead and I sent off a, you know, email to this, you know, Tanya Engst. Gee, it must have been his wife. And said, I've got this book. I would, you know, I'm just wondering if you guys would be interested in publishing it. Well, sure enough, I sent the manuscript. And Tanya Engst, probably more than anybody else I've run into, taught me how to be a writer. She really did.
She's cool.
She's also probably one of the best editors out there. So she did an amazing job of kind of getting me on the, you know, straight and narrow and learning how to be a writer. And so anyway, I was doing that. Starting in 1994, I actually set up a website. As soon as I found a company in the Denver area that would do web hosting, I set up a website. It was called Pedantic, PDANTIC.com. And I talked about all sorts of PDAs, like the Newton Message Pad. When the Palm Pilot came out, I was talking about that. When the first Pocket PC devices came out from Microsoft, I wrote about those. And so it was like in a very early sense, I guess you could say it was blogging. And I did ran that site actually up until the early 2000s, and then I changed names a couple of times on the site. And in 2009, I don't know how it happened, but somehow a friend of mine sent me a note and said, "Hey, I see this website, the unofficial Apple weblog, Tua, is looking for writers. You ought to try it out."
Ah, this is where I'm going to have to interrupt you.
Oh, okay.
I want to talk about Tua when we come back.
Sure.
So we need to take a short break right now. And when we return, I want to ask you about Tua. And then I want to ask you about Apple World Today. And then I want to ask you about what you think of some of Apple's products. So we will be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. Thanks, Kelly. All right. So, Steve, I want to hear about Tua and how that started.
Yeah, well, that was kind of funny because I think it was two articles or something like that. You just submitted them. I sent them in, didn't hear a thing. The next April, I was in, I keep thinking, someplace in North Carolina. I can't remember where it was, but I was teaching a class there. I was doing some training at the time and teaching a class, and my phone rings. I pick it up, and it's Scott McNulty. Who at that time was one of the editors at Tua. And he said, "Hey, we definitely are interested in having you write. I just want a couple more. I want to see how you work under pressure." And I said, "Well,
oh, that's inspiring."
It was great. I said, "I'm at the airport right now. My flight leaves in about, an hour and a half." And he goes, "Good, you can write an article for me." And he said, "Here's the topic," and he threw out something about a wonderful new Apple device that, of course, was totally false. But anyway, I sat down, I wrote I think it was probably about a 500-word article about it, submitted it to him, and he said, "You're hired." So that's how I got started, writing an article for Tua at this airport. It was Raleigh-Durham. That's where it was. But anyway, got that done. And then I wrote for them up until earlier this year. And unfortunately, AOL shut down the unofficial Apple weblog. Not sure why, but all of us who were working there promptly got the axe. So a couple of us got together and decided to start up a new site. And that's called Apple World Today or appleworld.today.
How does that domain .today work?
Well, it's funny because we actually had some people at the beginning who were going, "I don't understand the appleworld.today, but .today is a valid top-level domain. So it works just fine.
Cool.
But just in case, we went ahead and also got the domain appleworldtoday.com.
Mm-hmm.
And so either one of those will direct you to the website.
I've taken a look at it. It's awfully nice.
Well, thank you. You wouldn't believe how quickly we put that site together. We actually, I think our last day with AOL was on February 3rd, and the site was up February 6th.
Nice.
So it was a lot of running, screaming, and not sleeping for a couple of nights.
That's something unique about the Apple community, is how much enthusiasm. There's all these different sites with different angles and different philosophies and different staff that support the Apple community in so many different ways.
Absolutely. And that's one thing I just love about, you know, like you said, about the community. You've got so many different points of view. You know, sometimes, unfortunately, I think a lot of bloggers tend to almost go in lockstep when it comes to, for instance, the other day, was it yesterday, when the ugly Apple battery pack for the iPhone 6S came out, or 6 and 6S, it was like you could go out to Twitter and it was nothing but universal condemnation of this thing.
Well, I agree. I think it looks like the iPhone is trying to have a little baby iPhone and it's bulging out the back.
Yeah, it's not
ugly.
It's not their best.
No.
There, but anyway, it just it was kind of odd because it was just all this repetition out there of the same thing from.
Well, in this case, I kind of got the feeling that it was not just an echo chamber, but it was a mutual community reaction where people were going, "Yeah, I agree," and then everybody else went, "Yeah, I agree too."
And I agree you agree.
I think Apple should withdraw it from the market and redesign it.
Oh, honestly, it is bad. I'd say it's probably one of their worst looking products in a long time. It's just plain ugly.
Let's talk about something happier. I know you have an iPad Pro like I do, and I wanted to hear your thoughts about this new kind of iPad from Apple.
Well, I love it.
I love it too.
It's so funny because I earlier this year, because I was going on a long trip during the summer, I at the time my sole laptop computer, had been owned by AOL, so they of course wanted it back when they laid me off. So I went out and I bought one of the 12-inch MacBooks. Now, the funny thing about the 12-inch MacBook, two things that I found weird about it was, first of all, whenever I wanted to plug something into it, I always had to go, crap, I don't have an adapter for that. I may have to go buy it, which really, really upset me because I've got tons of different adapters and I couldn't use them on that thing with the USB-C port. So that was the first complaint. My second complaint was that wonderful Retina display that's on the 12-inch MacBook looked so much to me like the screen of an iPad that I was constantly tapping the screen to try to do things.
I have seen that happen. Yes.
Well, I was totally guilty of doing that. So, fast forward to the announcement about the iPad Pro, and my first thought was, I know pretty much, right now I do a lot of work on the iPad. I wasn't using the MacBook that much.
Are you able to compose your Apple World Today articles and post them on the iPad Pro?
Absolutely.
Cool.
Well, we're fortunate. I could say fortunate and unfortunate in that we use a service called Squarespace. And the reason I say fortunate is we were able to ramp up very, very quickly. They can handle pretty much any size crowd. They've got great tech support. But sounds like an ad here, but it isn't. But I love Squarespace. I used to hate their iPad application. So when I was thinking about, are we going to go with WordPress or are we going to go with Squarespace, I revisited their app, and I found that it had vastly improved. And now that's what I write a lot of my articles in. I'm able to put all the photos in, do all the links, do everything that I need to do. And I can do it on the, I could do it on a smaller iPad. I love it on an iPad Pro.
All right, here's the jackpot question. what keyboard are you using on the iPad Pro?
As of an hour ago, I am using the Apple Smart Keyboard, which finally showed up. I ordered it at the same time I ordered the iPad Pro, and it finally showed up today.
How do you feel about that keyboard as a writer?
It's going to take me a little bit of getting used to, and I'm not saying that because of the feel of the keys. It's more because of the spacing of the keys. It's actually quite wide. What I've been using prior to that, I actually have a couple of different stands here. I've got a 12 South, what's it called, Park Slope that I was putting the iPad Pro onto. I was using a Logitech Keys to Go Bluetooth keyboard, you know, kind of as an external keyboard. The feel of the Keys to Go and the feel of the iPad Pro keyboard, or the Smart Keyboard, excuse me, are really similar. But the keys are a little bit closer together on the Keys to Go. And so my first problem that I ran into is my fingers were kind of running all over the place on that Smart Keyboard. It took me about maybe a minute to get used to it. And now I'm pretty impressed with it. I don't mind that keyboard. I know I've heard some other people who said they just didn't like the feel of it. Once I got used to the spacing of the keys, it feels perfectly normal to me.
Now, here's the thing I'm having a problem with on the iPad Pro, and I still haven't resolved it. If you put a case on the iPad Pro that contains a keyboard, like the Apple Smart Case or the Logitech Create, then you've got to carry around this keyboard when you don't need it, and when you're sitting with the iPad Pro in your lap, the keyboard is in the way. So it kind of calls out for a place of its own on your desk where you treat it as a workstation, and you have a keyboard sitting there that you connect to. And then when you want to take the iPad Pro around the office or around the house, and you grab it and detach it, and it's more comfortable to hold it in your hands that way, even though it doesn't have a case on it.
Yeah.
Is that how you're thinking?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that absolutely makes sense. The one thing, you know, I like the fact that I can indeed, in fact, I was writing an article here before we started talking, but I was using the iPad Pro. I love the fact that I could use it with the Smart Keyboard in that laptop mode. It really felt quite normal. It felt quite comfortable. That being said, I know when there are certain situations where there's no way I'm going to be able to use that as a laptop. For instance, if I happen to be sitting in coach on an airplane and the person ahead of me decides to move their seat back just a couple inches back, no way. It's not going to work.
That's where the MacBook comes into play. If I were traveling, I would probably take the MacBook because I'm an OS X kind of guy, and the MacBook has the tools I need for writing, and it's really small. The iPad Pro just towers over the MacBook. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's surprising because, you know, I almost feel like I'm back to a 13-inch MacBook Air thing. You know, it seems like it's about the same size. Well, the screen definitely is about the same size, but it's quite the remarkable computer. The one thing I did notice when I got the iPad Pro is that I found that some of my apps that I used quite a bit weren't exactly working well with iOS 9 at that point. I love one Markdown editor called Ulysses. I use it quite a bit. And unfortunately, they're not going to be set up for the iOS 9 multitasking until next spring, which is sad. You know, I really wish that they would speed
things up. I think it's going to take a while for these pro apps to come out, and I think it's going to take a while for Apple to come out with iOS 10 that better exploits the power of that A9X. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, you know, the good thing was I was able to go out and find a couple of apps that now I'm looking at, and I said, "What?" Or say, you know, "Wow, this is really an amazing tool." The one that I'm using on the iPad Pro, you know, kind of as my And I'm trying to get the get this all situated here now. Sorry about that. There we go. I'm trying to flip it out and bring up the... There we go. Yay. Got it working. Let's see. I've got to see if I can find this app because unfortunately I cannot remember the name of it. Oh, it's called OneWriter. And I love that thing. It's iOS 9 multitasking compliant. Works just great. I can put it in split screen mode. It also has a really pretty decent web browser built in, even though I find it's just easier to bring up a Safari window and use it. But I love that. I ended up buying a RSS reader app called Fiery Feeds that's, once again, iOS 9 compliant, I guess you could say. And, man, I tell you, between those and the Squarespace app and the WordPress app for some other writing that I do, I'm pretty happy.
Cool, cool. Well, before we went out of time, we've got just a little bit of time left. I wanted to ask you about your Apple Watch and what you think of it.
I really like it. I you know, it's funny because I wasn't sure I was going to like it. You know, mainly because there was so much emphasis on fitness and health tracking and activity tracking. And when I got it, I found that there were certain things that I absolutely used it for. One of those was to answer whatever the heck you want to call them, you know, messages, text messages when they'd come in. If I was sitting at a stoplight, instead of pulling out the iPhone and sitting there tapping the screen, instead I'd just say, reply or tap reply, say something, tap on the text, and it was sent.
And that's a heady experience. It really is.
I love it. Yeah, I really enjoy that. And I'm very happy with the Apple Watch. Got to admit it.
I have one too. And one of the joys is when my iPhone is someplace not real handy, and I get in an important phone call, just answer the phone call on the phone, Dick Tracy style. You feel like you're living in the future when you do that.
Man, I tell you, if they can ever make it so it has its own built-in cellular modem and has a lifetime of 24 hours or more of, anyway.
Oh, yeah, we'll be doing FaceTime on our Apple Watches in a few years.
Yeah.
We really will. I predict it. Well, I think we're just about out of time. Thank you very much. This has been fascinating. I wish we had more time because there were all sorts of things that I wanted to ask you about that we didn't get to, but I think we'd have to wrap it up for now. Steve, tell us how the listeners can contact you.
Well, listeners can contact me either by going to the website, which is appleworld.today or appleworldtoday.com. And I'm also on Twitter at Steven Sande, StevenSande.
All right. Cool. Thank you again for being on the show, Steve. We'll talk again soon. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for coming by. And we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.